Hello and welcome to Arcane Connection, episode 9. And today I'm delighted to say we have a very special guest joining us. We're recording him all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. It's Andrew Granowski, a name I'm sure is very, very familiar to all Ars Magica players out there. Andrew, would you like to say, for those who are not as familiar as me with the development of 5th edition, a little bit about the books you've worked on so far, and your involvement with the game over the years?
Yes, CJ. Thank you, CJ. Yes, I'm currently the editor and webmaster of Project Redcap, and I encourage everyone to check out that resource. I took over for David Chart when his duties as line editor prevented him from devoting the time he felt the project deserved. I'm afraid that it's perhaps a bit out of the frying pan and into the fire in that regard. I've been writing for Ars Magica off and on since 5th edition came out. I was a playtester for 5th edition, and I can't quite give you the story for how that came to pass. I don't think we have time. And I wrote the Book of Mundane Beasts, which was an early web supplement for 5th edition. And I wrote for Houses of Hermes Societates. I wrote the House Flambeau chapter for that book. I also contributed to Realms of Power Magic. I wrote the small contribution to Lords of Men, the combat chapter appendix. And Antagonists, yes, most recently.
Really, anything in Ars Magica that a Grog or a Magi may have to fight or oppose, you're responsible for?
There's a theme emerging here. Now, interestingly, I did not write for the Grog's book.
Oh, okay, I had a number of authors, but you never wrote for Grog's.
No, I think it's not a breach of my NDA to say that I put together a pitch for it, right. But David Chart thought that the other pitches were better, and having seen the result, I'm inclined to agree.
It's the way these things go, is you pitch for books, you hope for the best, and sometimes you get them and sometimes you don't, and I'm sure we all respect David's decisions at the end of the day, which is why we still write for the line.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm trying to be diplomatic and tactful here. I'm trying to think. No, I mean, I do think David's done a fantastic job over the years with the line, and I think you've done a fantastic job with Project Redcap, and I'm just sorry that in recent weeks I've not had the time I had before to do a bit more editing, but I mean, there are a couple of you who are doing absolutely sterling work, and under your directorship, it has gone from strength to strength with the new wiki format, hasn't it?
I'm glad you like it.
I do, very much so. Now, today we're going to talk about those characters who are absolutely essential to any Ars Magica saga, or at least I like to think they're essential to any Ars Magica saga, but which don't get all the love and respect perhaps they should. That is Grogs. And as we've said, there's a book out on Grogs, which I found... actually, I'm going to review it sometime, because I think there's much in it which is absolutely excellent, and some items which I may disagree with a little, but I'm sure we all have those, you know, aspects with any book. Grogs is one of my favourite books, though, for Ars Magica. And the first question I suppose we have to ask is, what are Grogs? So how do you define a Grog?
Well, the definition of Grog has wandered a little bit over the years. In first edition Ars Magica, which I had the pleasure to play, it was really a diamond in the rough. Grogs were strictly warriors. They were bodyguards for the Magi. They were fighting characters who, actually, the rulebook made no bones about the fact that they were designed to be expendable. Today, and in the Grog's book, in 5th edition generally, and I think it really started in 4th edition, the definition of Grog is broader, that it's any servant who's closely affiliated with the Magi or the Covenant. I think that's the context in which we need to interpret the word Grog today, the term.
We had that conversation a few weeks ago as to whether or not, you know, Grog meant coven folk or gods, but I think you were right. In 5th edition, Grog means both. It's gone beyond the original definition.
An important point is that not every Ars Magica saga involves combat or action in a physical sense. So a fighting Grog might not have a role depending on a group's play style. And that's perfectly all right. It's not my play style, by the way. I think you can tell from the combat emphasis of my writing contributions to the line, that I do like a good fight, but different styles for different groups. And I do think that Grogs can still have a role, even when there's not a lot of physical conflict in the saga.
One of the things I noticed, actually, was that in our group, for a long time, under 4th edition, the players ended up all wanting to take their Magi in every adventure, and they became so potent for it as a result, and so specialised in dealing with the outside world and not bothering to stay in the thing and developing combat skills, that the Grogs became almost irrelevant. And it was only with 5th edition and the emphasis on the gift, and the gift penalty being much greater, that Grogs become important. Very, very important, just to allow you to get by in mundane society and talk to people without them running away. Or would you disagree with that emphasis? Or
no, I fully agree. As a matter of fact, and it's perfectly a legitimate way to play Ars Magica for all players to play their Magi all the time. That's not the way I came up with. In my experience, and I think that it has to do with starting with first edition, when all of these ideas were new and they had to be explained very clearly for an audience who, by definition, hadn't played Ars Magica before, that the value of the Grog's role was really spelled out well. And I do think that that's an emphasis that has diminished, hasn't been carried forward as strongly in 4th and 5th editions, and that may be a reason why there's a little less interest in Grogs from the newer players. And so I just wanted to have this podcast to talk about how wonderful Grogs are and how to have a good experience with playing them.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the most memorable characters in all of my sagas have been the Grogs. Even in the early one where I said they all ended up playing the magicians most of the time, there were a couple of characters like Blue the Boatman who, you know, came to define. One of the issues for me recently has been that under 5th edition, with no magic resistance at all, as always with Ars Magica, the poxiest little demon can easily take over your Grogs and render them completely unplayable for a session.
In a way, they can be a liability. That's quite true. So CJ, in the group of yours that wanted to play the Magi all the time, the alternative is to use Grogs. Why do you think that there are Grogs in the game? Why do we have Grogs, in your opinion? I have my own opinion.
The classic description of them from the rulebook is that they're like the bit parts in Shakespeare. They provide low comedy. That's something I explored actually in a Sub Rosa adventure I wrote. I don't know if you've seen the last issue of Sub Rosa, but I wrote an adventure where a bunch of Grogs go to tribunal, and it's called Love Labour's Lost or Kicking Darius the Flumbo Up the Arse.
and it is a Father Ted reference.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reference to Father Ted kicking Bishop Brennan up the arse. It involves elements of The Quiet Man. The female heroine in it is based upon Maureen O'Hara's character in that. And the actual main plot of the adventure, obviously, has Shakespearean overtones. It's about what the Grogs get up to when the Magi are all busy and are doing other things and they're left to run riot. And, I mean, that's the role that they've often played in my campaign, is to counterpoint, the other themes of the story from the perspective of those people who are affected by magic but don't wield that power. They represent the common man of mythic Europe in my games. But that's just my way of doing it. So how do you see them?
I fully agree that they represent the common man of mythic Europe, and I think that the value of Grogs is that they tie the mythic Europe setting back to a medieval, believable human setting.
Yep.
Because the Magi live in covenants, their own towers, maybe even in a regio, completely detached from the world, and they're speaking Latin and hardly want to go outside. And the Grogs really let the player experience mythic Europe up close.
Yep, absolutely. They tie them back to the real world of the of actual Europe and in the Middle Ages. So, I mean, they also have a fantastic role in terms of they provide for actual combat adventures and the fun things of old D&D. I mean, I was a Dungeons and Dragons player in the 70s and 80s. Late 79, I bought the Monster Manual. I had the basic D&D set. And throughout the 80s, I played D&D and then a lot of RuneQuest. I was quite into RuneQuest for many years. And a lot of my role-playing experience in those early days was dungeon bashing and was fighting the monster. And it's something I still enjoy. And in fact, one of my players, Phil, said on my Facebook earlier today that he wished we could get back to more of that kind of role-playing.
Well, make some grogs, no problem.
Yeah.
And, yes, and it's... Especially if you don't want your Magus to be a big fighter.
Yeah.
But you still, for instance, maybe you want to play a Quasitor, an investigator, or so on. The Grog can be the bodyguard, right, who at the critical moment protects the Magus from the assassin or something of that kind. And that's another nice thing about Grogs is that they're present in the story, but they don't have to be in the foreground all the time. They're very permissive kinds of characters that give the players in the story guide some freedom to switch scenes that it can be valuable for story pacing purposes.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, they have a functional role of stopping. I mean, with the new close combat rules in Ars Magica 5th, they can automatically get in the way of most attacks on your mages before they actually come about. But you can also see them in some ways as very, very human characters, and there's much sadness when they die, I find.
And that does happen from time to time.
Occasionally,
they can be fragile.
Occasionally, they do actually go on to become companions in my game. A lot of characters who started off as humble grogs went on to be elevated to companions after, you know, 10 or 20 years of gameplay because everyone grew to love them so much. And they were, you know, something happened and we agreed that they would make a good companion and they were elevated to that role, which the rules don't really cover, but I think it's something that organically grows out of the game and makes sense in some contexts.
Well, the rules in Grogs do cover it.
Yeah.
Myself, I think that's gilding the lily a bit, that I don't know if detailed rules are really necessary for that, but they're available in the Grogs book. And I've had that happen myself. As a matter of fact, we had a Grog one time who was literally just he was a halberd carrier, not a spear carrier, but he was just a spear carrier. We just wanted some extra muscle, so we rolled up this quick Grog and then played him for a bit. And a real personality emerged for him through play, and he ended up becoming a companion in two sagas, not just one. We actually moved him from one saga to another. That was great fun.
One of the things that I've noticed with Grogs is that sometimes they do actually take on more of a role than the companions do. And one of the things that we're doing in our current scenario, our current saga, we've just started a new saga after years and years and years of playing a variant Stonehenge setting. We're now playing a game set in Greece in the Thebes Tribunal, where most of the Magi are Bjorne. Are you still with me, Andrew?
I am.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, most of the Magi are Bjorne. And in that particular setting, we've got a very, very strict rule that only a couple of the Magi go out on any given adventure or are involved in any given story to make sure that people get a bit of play out of their grogs and out of their companions. What do you think is it? What is it really, though, in game function terms rather than in rules terms that makes the difference between a grog and a companion?
Well, to me, it's their importance to the story. In 5th edition, this is explicit. Grogs do not have story flaws, so grogs don't, by design, drive stories. They participate in stories. My distinction is simpler. In my saga, we use troop-style play, and grogs can be shared. They have a player responsible for their maintenance and advancement over seasons and so on.
Yep.
But grogs can be picked up and played by any player.
Yep.
And companions belong to a player.
Yeah, we used to have a grog pool in the Elva Rosa game. Now, because we've only played a few sessions, everyone's tending to play the same grog. And again, we use the same system, but grogs can be played by anyone in any thing, and they're a great thing for a pickup character if somebody's new to the game and wants to get involved. Every so often we'll have somebody who's down for a weekend and who'd really, really loves Ars Magica but doesn't live close enough to play regularly. They tend to play Grogs, which can work really well.
Yes, and it can be a good way for guest players to get started in the game, especially if you have a Magus player who's very good at handling Grogs, and we'll get to that later. The Grog pool, I'm afraid I'm jumping around too much, but I did want to talk a bit more about the Grog pool, because the Grog pool can be a lot of fun and can help develop the characters a lot as you pass the Grog around to different players, and they each have a slightly different interpretation that enriches the character and makes them take on a life of their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's one of the most valuable aspects of the Grog. I noticed one of the things you wanted to talk about was myths about Grogs, and I think that's quite interesting. So what would you say your top three myths about Grogs are?
Well, I would say that the top myth about Grogs is that they're no fun, because they're not leaders, and they don't drive stories, and so you know, that there's no fun in playing a Grog. And I disagree with that completely, because for one thing, as you mentioned with the gift, especially the way it's portrayed in 5th edition, Grogs can do things that Maggie cannot do, and that is to immerse themselves in Mythic Europe.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, trying to arrange a boat trip, or trying to go through a town, or trying to do any kind of investigation is almost impossible without a character. Though, of course, companions can take that role as well.
And that's why Grogs are completely optional.
You know.
There's nothing that a Grog can do that a companion can't do.
The washing up, so, the cooking. The build to campfire.
Yeah,
because a lot of players won't let their companion do that. You know,
won't do.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, what else? What other myths do you think there are about Grogs then?
Well, the Grogs don't get to make decisions that are important or that affect the story. And I think we already dispelled that one when you were talking about how central they can be to investigations. And I'll give you a little example, maybe a bit of an extreme example, but from my early days playing first edition, when nobody knew what we were doing, right? We were discovering our playstyle as we went along, and there was this tense standoff between a rival Magus and his Grogs, and our player Magus and our Grogs. And the Magi were bickering back and forth in Latin. The Grogs didn't speak Latin. And there was one Grog who was a very unsavory, cutthroat type of person that maybe wasn't a great candidate to have as a Grog, but good help is hard to find. And he decided that the talking was going on too long and a fight was going to come. And he decided that if a fight was going to come, he wanted to take the first shot. So he did. And he actually started the battle.
Okay. Yes. And that's actually not an uncommon experience, because in my game, one of the things that quite often happens is a Grog wanders off to do something, becomes lost in a mist, finds the radio, and, you know, everybody else spends the rest of the adventure trying to rescue the Grog.
And there's another way to play that, by the way, which is the Grog finds this stuff and comes running back to tell everybody what a wonderful thing he's found.
Well, yeah, that does happen sometimes. I mean, we actually had a companion character, Paul the Red Cap, who left the campaign because his player decided he was going to make off with all of the silver, and being a thoroughly disreputable type, go off and spend it on women and good times. But it wasn't quite a Grog, but a few of the Grogs have actually led to stories, and we had a whole series of stories in which they tried to catch up with Paul the Red Cap, played by Tom. But we also had the retirement of one of the Grogs. There was one particularly very, very large, giant-blooded Grog who was not of the brightest and who was becoming very elderly, and it was decided that he should retire with a pension, and the players spent an entire story buying him a farm and setting him up, and that was enjoyable, very enjoyable part of the game, actually, you know, in which we examined the relationship between the powerful Magi and the actual Grogs, and how far they would go to look after one of their own when the time came.
And it's these relationships that are the most wonderful things about grogs. One of the things I like when I create a grog is to think about why on earth a character in Mythic Europe would go to work for the Maggi, to risk his life and honor for the Maggi.
So, I'm sure some would regard, you know, them as inherently questionable individuals, considering some of the things they do.
Well, in my sagas, they're usually a bunch of misfits of some kind.
Yep. Okay.
How's our audio? Are we having trouble?
No, I think we're okay now. I thought for a moment that we dropped out, but we haven't. So, I mean, more than just fighters, more than just D&D fighters, grogs are a lot more than that, don't you think?
I certainly do. They are in our saga. I mean, in Ars Magica, combat is kind of complex, and we don't have as much combat in our saga as we do in a D&D game. There will be maybe one battle in an evening. So the grogs have to be useful in other contexts, and we make them to be so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would say that's a common mistake, is to start out with a grog and try to make him the best warrior you can make. You can make a very impressive warrior with the 5th edition rules, with the right choice of virtues and so on, but that's really missing the point. Grogs are not supposed to be the most powerful characters that they can be. Not powerful in the sense of their game statistics and their performance. Hopefully they'll be powerful characters in the sense of their character development and their relationships with other Maggi and other characters. But they're inherently weaker characters than companions or Maggi. They're lower in social standing usually, and they lack magical ability. They can be vulnerable to magical threats and so on. As a role player, I often find that, although it's not always comfortable, that exploring my character's vulnerabilities or frailties is a lot of the fun of playing a character.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, actually, in our game, we quite often have both the Magi, as I would say here, and the one thing I should say is that in England we've got a terrible tendency, not being David, to pronounce things in the standard English way, and be very, so you'll quite often find us talking about Viz or instead of Weiss, and Magi instead of Maggi. I know how to, because Neil Taylor and David's group actually do preserve the correct Latin pronunciations, but we only see those at Grand Tribunal most of the time, so you'll have to forgive me if I wander off into a barbaric English tongue and rather than Latin.
My wife has a degree in medieval studies from Harvard University, and she isn't here, fortunately.
I did Latin at school, but only from the age of 9 to 12, and I was diabolical at Latin, actually. The only thing I was worse at was New Testament Greek. And I failed both of those. The only exams I've ever failed in my life were Latin, Greek, and Biblical Hebrew. So you can absolutely guarantee that when it comes to languages, I have the anti-linguist flaw. So let's return to the actual plot. How do you think, what are the best ways to use grogs then? I mean, we use them a lot in our troop style play. We do play troop style. And I've said, in 5th edition, I've noticed that seems to have been downplayed quite a bit. Or do you think that's just me? Or do you think the rules are less emphatic?
Troop style is less emphasized. There's less ink spent on grogs in 5th edition.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of a general de-emphasis of combat, but it's a bit of a missed opportunity. And the grog's book, in large part, rectifies this, because the grog's book is all about the usefulness of grogs in the saga, and grogs within the Covenant, and grogs as a interface between the Covenant and the rest of society. So there's a whole book on grogs, but the core rule book is a little light on advice for how to play grogs. And I think one of the most important things for a player of grogs is, and this is spelled out in first edition very clearly, is that you have to get in the right frame of mind to play a grog. You have to accept that you're just less powerful
than other characters. And you also have to, you have to be a good follower. You have to be ready to subordinate your character, even role-playing opportunities maybe, to the group goals.
Yep.
You know, showing off or trying to grab the limelight is not what the Grog's player should be doing. Now, a good Magus player will create opportunities for the Grogs to do things.
Yeah, rather than just tell them what to do and treat them as skivvies and servants, which there's nothing more in a role-playing game that's going to offend a player and make them not enjoy a game than a strong leadership hierarchy where they have no choices but are just pushed around by another player. That's always
right. No one wants to play that. So we do need to talk about how the player of the Magus and maybe the companions have to create room for the Grogs to have latitude and to participate in the story. And I'll give you an example of this. Again, the first edition rulebook told me how to do this, but I think it was my second story ever. My Magus had two Grogs with him, and they were going to a town looking for some ancient enchanted dagger that he knew was there. My Magus was a young Magus, hadn't much adventuring experience, so we got to the town and went through a lot of trouble trying to get lodging, and we finally got lodging by renting out an entire inn. My Magus at that point, you know, that had taken an hour of, you know, in-character time. And Mamaga said, wow, that was really harder than it needed to be. And he was just delighted to have the inn now to himself and not to have to deal with mundanes anymore. So he went upstairs and unpacked a couple of books that he brought with him to study and said to the Grogs, all right, I'll be here studying. You guys go out and find the magic dagger and bring it to me when you got it. And
excellent.
Yes. And they went out and found all kinds of things.
Yeah, but that's the example of a player who enables other players to have a good time, and yeah, I think that's an excellent example of what you can do. I use Grogs a great deal for parts that we pick them up in stories sometimes, and somebody will play a character who they've encountered, be it a curious nun or a washerwoman or a maidservant. We've got, of our current Grogs in the party, we've got a milkmaid who somebody decided to play as their primary character. That's Lloyd's Grog, Sophie. Anastasia, who's another maidservant, and it's quite an interesting mixture of characters, but as I say, they quite often play both their magi and their Grog in the same session.
Yes, I find that very valuable, especially if you design the Grog to offset the Magus. Yeah. So where the Magus is strong, the Grog is weak, and vice versa. So one of those characters can be in the background, and you always have one who can be in the foreground.
We're running very short on time. I'm afraid we've only got about 5 minutes left. So one of the things I'm going to say is, what can go wrong with Grogs, in your opinion?
Well, player dynamics,
yep.
I would say. You know, it takes a certain amount of maturity to accept the role of a subordinate, and it also requires maturity to accept the role of a leader who's going to be willing to step aside and let the subordinates shine.
Yep.
And, you know, you may be better to not play Grogs. Grogs can be optional. You can have just companions. If your group isn't really comfortable, especially if you're new to Ars Magica, you're not really comfortable with the idea of having player characters subordinate to other player characters, maybe make companions and have companions and Maggie go out together.
Well, sometimes we normally have companions, the Magi and a couple of the Grogs. The Magi will bring a Grog each. Mm-hmm. So the problem with that is that we end up with parties of 10 or 12 characters to deal with, because I've got 6 players in the current game.
Yep.
And
that's another problem that you can run into with Grogs, is that you can have more characters than you have players at the table, and it can be cumbersome. You can forget about who's there.
Yeah.
And it can get quite silly, you know, to have this troop of 10 player characters, traipsing around the countryside in a long convoy. So give some thought to how many characters you want to have with you on an adventure, and bear in mind that although it's certainly possible and often desirable to play a Magus and a Grog opposite each other, you can also play Grogs by themselves. They make very suitable primary characters for the right kind of story.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Andrew, but I'm afraid we're almost out of time now, so let's end up with what would be your final piece of advice to people about how to best manage Grogs in a campaign.
That's a big question. I'll need to think about it for a moment.
Yeah, absolutely. As I've always said, don't get too attached to your Grog, because something terrible may well happen to them, but enjoy them for what they are and have as much fun with them as you can, because I think, you know, they are very special characters. I can't imagine playing ours.
I would say my advice would be to try to make room for Grogs in your stories and see what develops out of that.
Okay.
So all the players as a troop, get together, you know, and talk a little bit about this. Maybe listen to our podcast and try to create some stories where Grogs and Maggie work together.
Absolutely. Well, Andrew, it's been a pleasure talking to you, but we have a strict 30-minute rule, so maybe I can ask you if you'll return for the next episode, and we can discuss House Flambeau, or House Flambeau.
Oh, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I think that would be good fun. And I think if we were to do that for episode 10 of Arcane Connection, if you were willing to do that.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. Well, this has been Arcane Connection episode 8. I'm Chris Roma, CJ, and this was Andrew Kronowski. And with that, I'm going to sign off. Good night.